Good afternoon, Juneau. It's seconds before 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Joan Pardis is out today, and I'll be taking her show, and she'll be stepping in for me on a Friday coming up here pretty soon. Let's see. Today we have a great set of guests. There's going to be a few people here from Roller Girls. We're thinking most of the hit squad will be walking into the studio to tell us about their new season. Carla Hart, at least, will be here to talk about Auk Bay planning. We're hoping Ben Lyman shows up with her. And Lisa Warzenek, and there we go, will be here with a preview of her presentation tonight. It's on understanding adult guardianship. And we'll talk with photographer Chris Miller about a show of photographs of the Taku River that he'll be presenting this Wednesday at the Silver Bowl. That's all coming up on Juneau Afternoon, so stay tuned. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A United Nations official is in Canada meeting with the country's Aboriginal people and government officials. Dan Karpinchuk has more on the visit.
The United Nations dispatched its special representative on Indigenous rights to find out about the lives of First Nations in Canada. James Anaya is a professor of human rights law and policy at the University of Arizona. The UN has authorized him to make recommendations and come up with proposals to prevent and remedy violations of human rights inflicted on Indigenous peoples. The National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations in Canada, Sean Atleo, says Anaya's visit is an important one.
He will travel the country, meet with our people, and measure progress based on the principles set out in the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. This is an important moment of reflection, for his job is to help hold up a mirror to this country, so that we can see reflected back our reality to help compel the action that's urgently required for our children, our families, and our nations.
Anaya is responsible for promoting laws and policies that support Indigenous peoples around the world. He will look at living conditions and issue reports and recommendations. He has no binding authority, but his conclusions can shame governments into action by shining a spotlight on unacceptable conditions. One issue that's likely to come up is resource development on First Nations land. Anaya says in some cases, companies may have no choice but to significantly alter or even shelve projects that infringe on the rights of First Nations. The Canadian government will get an opportunity to respond to his findings before a final report is presented to the UN's Human Rights Council next year. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Seminole Tribe of Florida is joining the Menominee Nation on attempts to build an off-reservation gaming facility near Milwaukee. Some other tribes in the area don't support the project. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
The Seminole, through its business subsidiary Hard Rock International, has agreed to finance and manage the Menominee's project at Kenosha, Wisconsin. The site would have a 5,000-seat Hard Rock concert hall, restaurants, a hotel, and 3,000 slot machines and 75 table games. Seminole Board of Directors President Tony Sanchez says his tribe wants to help the less well-off Menominee.
You know what, I think that at the end of the day, in the grand scheme of things, in a Native American country, it's just this tribe getting the same opportunity as other tribes have received across the country.
The Seminole are not the Menominee's first financial partner in Kenosha. Other tribes, including the Mohegan, have put money into the long-delayed project before backing out. But after the federal government gave a preliminary okay for the casino this summer, Menominee Chairman Craig Korn says his tribe did not have to sweeten the deal for the Seminole.
Just the same terms that Mohegan had. You know, they're going to step into their shoes. There's a percentage of development, percentage of the management. That hasn't changed.
But the Kenosha project could still fall short. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker could still block the deal and says all Wisconsin tribes have to agree to the Kenosha casino. The Forest County Potawatomi, owners of a casino in nearby Milwaukee, are criticizing the Seminole-Menominee partnership, though reportedly talks between the tribes continue. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Tribal leaders from across the country are in Tulsa, Oklahoma this week for the National Congress of American Indians Annual Convention. Today, outgoing President Jefferson Keel and Executive Director Jacqueline Peta are outlining priorities for the week, including the impact of the shutdown, sequestration, and budget issues in Indian country. Other topics to be discussed are the ongoing debate over Indian mascots and the Baby Veronica case. Today, we remember the lead plaintiff in the historic class action Indian trust lawsuit Cobell v. Salazar. In October 2011, Eloise Cobell died after battling cancer. The Blackfeet woman led the more than a decade-long legal battle against the federal government over the mismanagement of individual Indian trust accounts. The suit ended with a more than $3 billion settlement. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's just coming up on 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore sitting in for Joan Pardis, his host for Juneau Afternoon today. And my first guest is just Julie. Julie Sandby is here, and she's a blocker with the Juneau Roller Girls, which you've got a new season coming up and all kinds of things going on, right?
Yeah, roller derby is always exciting. Got a lot on our calendar this season, and we're looking forward to kind of taking our fresh start. We just got off season. We had our off season July through, June, July, and August. So we've been rolling for a little over a month now, and it's always great to get back on the track.
How many people are involved in Juneau Roller Girls?
We've got roughly 30 skaters, and then we have a great group of dedicated officials, our referees and non-skating officials. Actually, at the last scrimmage we had, the players were outnumbered by officials. So we've got maybe 45-ish total
that are
involved in the league.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Broad range of everybody, different ages, different backgrounds, different day jobs, students, professionals, moms, dads, like the whole nine yards.
Yeah. How'd you get into it?
Well, I was really lucky to meet somebody back at kind of an early point, maybe 2006. Her name's Shanita Stretcher. She's currently a skater for Philly Roller Girls. Last World Cup, she was on the Team USA roster, very impressive skater, fantastic woman, came up here for a wedding and told me all about roller derby. Oh, Julie, you have to get into it. It's going to be the greatest thing. It'll change your life. I was like, oh my gosh, that sounds too crazy for me. I don't know if I can do it. It's like all rugged, all this hitting, like, oh, too, a little too rowdy for me. And the idea kind of baked for a couple of years. And in May 2010, Juneau Roller Girls was formed. I heard about it and I decided this is it. This is the time. I got to get in on this. I had no real skating background. I had, rolled around on skates a little bit when I was younger, but mostly skateboarding and, just kind of like that whole authentically rowdy experience. The league is great because you can come in with whatever skill level you have. If you have no background, no sports background, if you're not used to the whole being a team player thing, you can learn it all, and it's been great.
So now you're part of the Roller Girls, and your position is you're a blocker.
I'm a blocker.
Yeah.
Yep.
So what does a blocker do?
A blocker, my life goal, I guess, when I'm on the track, is giving the other team's jammer, the woman who scores points, a really hard time. I'm doing whatever I can to make sure she gains like 0 inches on the track. She should, hopefully be down on the ground or out of bounds.
Not flat down on the ground.
Well, there's definitely some thrills and spills in derby. So,
okay.
So I'm doing a lot of hitting. I'm doing a lot of what's called positional blocking, which is just obstruction and containment. It's working with my team. We have four blockers on the track at a time. So there's a lot of coordination happening between that defensive wall and trying to get your jammer, your point scorer through. Say, hey, come on over here. I've got a hole. Play offense and defense at the same time. It's really cool because of both those point scoring opportunities are on the track at the same time. They can score points at the same time that you can score points. So, for the first couple times you scrimmage, it's crazy. But then you get a feel for it. You get a taste for it. It's just I'm obsessed. I'm totally addicted. I can't get enough derby.
I have a roller derby friend who was telling me that she was out for some recreational skating with another member of the team. The two of them were skating just on a bike path.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody came up behind them on skates, and they the two of them moved a block without even thinking about it.
It does happen. You do it when you're, like, in the grocery store with a shopping cart. You're like, oh, no, I can't squeeze her out. That's really rude. You know, you try not to do it when you're driving. Like, you know, the whole, oh, yeah, different rules apply. No derby right now.
Well, let's take a look at the schedule. So
you got
your first home bout is November 16th.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's here. These are all at Centennial Hall,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah.
And then you got one on February 15th. March 22nd and May 31st is the last one of the season, is that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. So four home bouts.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got some pretty interesting stuff coming up on your away schedule.
Yeah. Alaska has a great roller derby community. So we're looking forward in the beginning of May. We'll be going up to Wasilla for the second annual All-Alaska Roller Derby Tournament. Great representation of Alaska's finest roller derby folk.
Mm-hmm.
We're also trying to make it down to Bremerton for the Wild West Showdown in March. That'll be, hopefully, our first outside tournament. Extremely exciting to be looking beyond Alaska's borders and seeing what kind of competition we can get. We also have an invitation from Whitehorse, and we're hoping to be able to go there. I think that date is April. The contract's still in negotiations, but
take it easy on the border guards when you go.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you've got something coming up, maybe an outside chance with Tokyo.
Oh, yeah. There's a little rumor mill bubbling right now. Rage City went to Tokyo, played two Japanese teams last year, and this year they're trying to come to Alaska, and we're trying to get in on that action. So if it happens, that'll be very, very exciting. We love playing Whitehorse. It's like a great international experience, and the idea of tacking on something like Tokyo, like,
and of course,
even
that
better.
Would almost require a return visit. If
oh,
it
wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I
see this. I see the whole travelogue unfolding in front of me. Now, people can get into this through a class, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Junior Roller Girls does open recruitment, which means any time is a good time for roller derby. But right now, we have a special opportunity. It's our intro to skating class that we run through community schools. It basically, you know, teaches you, you know, how to get on your skates, you know. And the class really caters to our class participants. So if you are very, very green, perfect, fantastic. If you're a little more seasoned and thinking that roller derby might be in your near future, it's a great time to, you know, get some time in with league skaters and get some experience. We also are really lucky to have our skating referees involved in the class. So it's men and women.
The class is open to men and women?
Mm-hmm.
Both?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay. So anyone who really wants to just get on skates, it's available.
Yep.
And this is through community schools,
through
so you have to go through
schools.
Their little registration
yeah.
process.
They have it on their website.
Okay.
It's junoschools.org.
Okay. And it's starting up?
It started the week before last. We had this past Sunday off. I guess there was a dance team.
Okay. So there's just been one class.
There's just been one class.
Yeah, all right.
We have nine more sessions. We have some gear available for loan. So if you are not 100% sure that you want to dedicate your life to skating but still want to try rolling with us, it's just a good opportunity.
Yeah. Okay. So the season begins November 16th, the Juno Roller Girls, and off to possibly, well, for sure, Wasilla, maybe
mm-hmm.
Whitehorse,
mm-hmm.
Maybe Bremerton.
Yeah.
Who knows? Just keep on rolling, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Good enough. Julie, thank you so much. Just Julie from the Juno Roller Girls. Julie Sandby, thank you.
No problem. Thanks, guys.
Where the watermelons grow, back to my home, I dare not go, for if I do. Bad night.
make me feel fine. Remember the time that a trucker from Dallas was callous to Queen Elizabeth's rude side. Now it can be now that a got much more than it bargained for. Queenie's right cross brought him to the floor. Now he knows better than to mess with the Queen of the Road Derby. You can jam all night, make a full-grown bumblebee die with pride. But when we get home alone in love, she murmurs like a sweet morning dove. Ooh, oh, something lady, she's quiet and shy. You make me feel good and there's a heart of mine. She's my love, she's a lady, she's a queen of the road up there, baby. Queen of the roller derby.
Queen of the roller derby.
Talk about the queen of the roller derby.
Queen of the roller derby.
She's the queen of the roller derby.
Queen of the roller derby.
Oh, queen of the roller derby.
Queen of the roller derby.
She's the queen of the roller derby.
Well, the roller derby season is coming right up, as we just heard from our first guest. So Saturday, November 16th, circle that date on your calendar and go out and support the Juno Roller Girls. And another date that you want to circle on your calendar is coming up October 15th. That's real close. And there's another one on Saturday as well. So my two guests who are here to tell us about this are part of the planning operation for Auk Bay. Carla Hart, the Friends of Auk Bay, is here, and Ben Lyman, who's the CBJ planner. And we're going to be holding some kind of public meeting on the 15th. So what's happening?
Well, we're doing a community kickoff meeting, and or actually a series of meetings, I should say. We're going to be starting tomorrow night out at UAS in the Egan Library in the classroom wing in the Glacier View room, and then we're going to be repeating in the same location on Saturday. And these meetings, although they're scheduled to go for 3 hours each, starting at 9 o'clock in the morning on Saturday and going until noon, and starting at 6 and going until 9 tomorrow night, we're going to be doing a short presentation for the first 15, 20 minutes of each hour. So at 6 o'clock, at 7 o'clock, and 8 o'clock tomorrow night, and then at 9, 10, and 11 in the morning on Saturday. So no one needs to be there for 3 hours unless they're really interested. I think Carla will probably be there. But aside from that, we're trying to make it easy for people to stop by, hear what's going on, register their concerns, their ideas. At this point, we're in listening mode. We want to be hearing what the community wants out of this planning process, what they want for the future of Auk Bay. We do have some direction in our comprehensive plan that was adopted in 2008 by the CBJ Assembly, but we need to flesh that out and make sure that we as staff are looking at the right geographic area. Are we just looking at the core of Auk Bay? Are we looking a larger area that, you know, would include maybe Auk Lake and Fritz Cove Road and out to Auk Rec? Where exactly are the parameters, and what exactly does the community hope to get out of this process? So that's where we are right now. We've got a survey going on online. There's a project webpage that's at www.juno.org/AukBayPlan, all one word. With links to documents and surveys and the meeting information there and my own contact information as well.
Now, if you just Google Auk Bay Planning, the page comes right up, and it's quite good, particularly as you roll down on the page. There's a bunch of really nice maps down there that help us who think visually, so
right.
Really excellent collection of maps. So, Carla, you kind of drafted yourself into the role of the Friend of Auk Bay, I think, a couple of years ago, right?
I did. When DOT was starting their planning for their highway, or announced that they were planning to remove DeHarts as part of their highway plan, I got involved and helped to draft a petition that the Auk Bay businesses circulated. And in that petition, we had 1,200 people signing, asking both to do something to keep DeHarts, which DOT did, thank you, and to plan for a livable, walkable, vibrant community to play, work, live, study. And it's taken a bit to get that through the city process and to get it budgeted for time and funds, but we're here now, and I see my role at this point is to help to make sure that the community turns out and shares their ideas on what they want so that it truly is a community plan.
So this public meeting, by the way, a lot of people use Auk Bay who don't live there. So this is open to everybody.
Absolutely, yeah. We're holding it in Auk Bay because we wanted to provide some context and we wanted to try and engage people in that area. But certainly people who live in Douglas, people who live in the valley, downtown, people who pass through Auk Bay with towing their boat behind their truck or have friends who live out the road, anybody and everybody is welcome to come in. And Auk Bay is really kind of a gem in the larger Juneau community. And everyone has a role to play in this. And we need to make sure that everyone's voice is heard and that we can incorporate the ideas of the entire community in this planning process.
Are there particular groups that you're hoping will show up at the meetings? In other words, is there like a constituency that you're concerned their voice is not going to be heard?
We're doing a lot of different outreach. We're working directly with individual agencies. From UAS and Docks and Harbors and DOT, we'll be meeting with NOAA and U.S. Forest Service staff, and so we're going both for the agencies that have properties and that manage resources in the area, as well as sending out notices to area residents. We want to make sure that people who do live in the area have a chance to be involved, and certainly anybody else. At this point, I'm not terribly concerned that a particular constituency won't be represented. After all, Carla's done a really fantastic job of rounding up the community, and she's got a huge mailing list and a huge Facebook group, and so she's really done a lot of the hardest work that we as community planners often struggle with, which is engaging the community. And Carla's taken a lot of that load off of my plate. Thank you very much. And so now we can use that group as a resource to make sure that people are engaged and are participating. I'm not, again, terribly concerned about a particular constituent group in this case that will be underrepresented, because I think there'll be advocates for just about every group that uses the Auk Bay area. We'll just have to see if we're just kicking off this process this week, and if we notice that there are people who are not being represented, then we'll have to go a little bit further to try and reach out to them. We've also been working with individual property owners and business owners in the Auk Bay area and trying to do one-on-one meetings with all of them and make sure that we understand what their hopes, dreams, desires for the neighborhood are.
So right now the road is all torn up, and they're talking about maybe being able to finish the traffic circle by
roundabout.
Okay, so they're hoping that the roundabout will be finished this fall, but they've also announced that if that's not done, then they'll do some kind of paving, temporary paving thing to make it a little more drivable for the winter. That's pretty much almost guaranteed to be done next year. I guess what I'm looking for is what is the timeline from these meetings forward start to look like? What's the next thing that's going to happen out at Auk Bay?
Well, the Docks and Harbors project with Statter Harbor is moving along as well. They've, I believe, finished up on phase one with the first set of floats, and will be moving forward in the next few years. University of Alaska Southeast is building 120 new freshman dorms, so that's a pretty big investment in that area. A lot of new housing, a lot of new residents coming into the area with that project. We've got several other private developers who are looking at developing their properties. Actually have another neighborhood meeting out in Auk Bay at the fire station this evening. That's going to be starting at 5 o'clock and it'll go until 6:30. It's a rezoning application of the Auk Bay post office property and a single-family residence right across the street next to the fire station. The owner of the post office would like to convert the vacant office space on the first floor to residential units. And the post office is not going to be renewing their lease, and they'll be moving out in about 5 years. And so at least that's the word that the owner of the property has received. And so in order to convert that space to residential uses, he needs to change the zoning to allow additional residential use. So we're going to be having a neighborhood meeting again on that from 5 to 6:30 tonight at Auk Bay Fire Station. So we do have some of these private developments that are going along. in terms of the Auk Bay planning effort, we're really trying to incorporate those owners and developers in our discussion. But we also can't, you know, there's no moratorium. We can't hold them off until we manage to make the planning wheels go forward and get a plan for the area. So we're just trying to engage them and help them understand the costs and benefits of waiting or moving forward at this point. In terms of DOT and the road reconstruction project, which is really what got Carla involved, she noted, and as you noted, the roundabout was redesigned and is under construction currently. There are actually two different projects that the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities was doing out there. That roundabout and then going up to the back entrance, or now the only entrance to UAS, is one of those projects. The other is the reconstruction of Glacier Highway, roughly from the intersection with Fritz Cove Road north to Seaview Avenue, so just north of the Auk Bay Village area. And that project raised a lot of concerns both among city staff and in the community. It was really designed as a facility to move automobile traffic through the village. It didn't do much to improve the area for the pedestrian experience, and there was some concern that it may result in higher vehicle speeds through the area. And there's already a bit of speeding in the area, even without the reconstruction. So that DOT is kind of holding off on that project and letting us play catch-up, which is very kind of them. We do need to keep moving on this quickly so that they don't lose their funding on that project. But we also want to try and make sure that that road section and that design reflects the needs of the community and is a little bit more all-inclusive in its design process.
This sounds like we've covered a lot of ground here. I guess one thing we should mention is if you can't make either of these two meetings, there is a survey on the website which you're using to gather information as well. And it has some really interesting there's one of the questions lists a number of multiple uses for the Auk Bay area, and just looking at that tells you that we really, as a community, have a lot of different reasons for the existence of Auk Bay. I think there's like 12 or 13 choices on there, or something like that. Yeah. It's just it was the list really. It was hard not to check all of them because sooner or later you get involved in every bit of it.
I think if you look at that, you see that Auk Bay really is a community. It has a post office, a school, a university, businesses, service industry businesses, as well as retail and restaurants. So it's a vibrant place.
Yeah, absolutely. And at this point, again, we're really looking for, we're trying to take the pulse of the community. And so if you do take that survey, feel free to check every box. there are a few of them that wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. If you said that Auk Bay doesn't need any more housing, and you also said it needed more housing, that wouldn't make much sense. But aside from that, we're really trying to get a good idea of what the community wants out there. So, please... Google the Auk Bay plan and take that survey, and feel free to send me an email. I've got my email address all over that web page, so I'm the official contact on it, and I'm looking forward to hearing from people. We're also looking for volunteers for the plan steering committee. We're going to be getting a group of nominations together, list of nominated names, and then the Planning Commission in November will be selecting from that list to create a steering committee from the plan for the plan. So it won't be staff such as myself who are running the planning process. It'll be Auk Bay residents, visitors, people who use the harbor, helping to provide direction and make sure that we stay on track and that we reflect the needs of the community in the plan.
Okay. Carla?
And if I could, we have a Friends of Auk Bay site at Facebook, and I know not everybody's a Facebook user, but it was the easiest way for us to set this up. So if you're just interested in keeping an eye on Auk Bay things, finding out if there are bears getting into people's cars or whales in the harbor or a meeting coming up, I invite people to just search Friends of Auk Bay on Facebook and ask to join that group.
Okay, so one more time now. The first meeting is tomorrow night, 6 to 9 p.m. These are both in the classroom area of Egan. Are you in the big lecture hall? Or where?
Yeah, they're upstairs in the classroom wing of the Egan Library.
Okay, in the lecture hall there. Yeah, okay. And then the second meeting, which is the same agenda, is on Saturday from 9 o'clock in the morning until noon.
Right.
In the same location,
yep.
Right?
And again, even though those meetings are 3 hours long, they're done in single-hour increments. So we'll be doing a presentation on the hour, followed by question and answer, small group discussion, and then at the next hour, we'll start another presentation. So no need to be there for the whole time.
Outstanding. Okay, well, thank you, Carla. Thank you, Ben, for coming in and letting us know this. Okay.
Thank you very much.
See you later.
And here is the Writer's Almanac from Monday. It's the 14th of October, 2013. It's the anniversary of the Battle of Hastings, 1066, on this day. William the Conqueror, William, Duke of Normandy, left France with 10,000 men, disembarked in Sussex, moved along the coast to Hastings. Meanwhile, Harold II was fighting off an army of Vikings in the north. He hurried his army south. William sent his army to attack, archers in front, infantrymen behind, knights in the rear. The Normans feigned retreat. They lured the English from their positions and then turned and annihilated them. And the Normans moved on to London, where William was crowned king on December the 25th. It's the birthday of Dwight D. Eisenhower, born Denison, Texas, 1890, grew up in Abilene. One of seven brothers, went off to West Point. During World War I, Eisenhower was assigned to train troops for combat. He wanted to get an overseas assignment. And finally, he was given permission to go to France and take command of a unit on November 18th. And 1 week before that, the war came to an end. Eisenhower told a friend, "By God, from now on, I am cutting myself a swath and will make up for this." And he did. He worked his way up. After Pearl Harbor, he was put on the War Plans Division in Washington. And by December of 1943, he was Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. He was in charge of planning the invasion of Normandy. The Allies needed a full moon so they could see well enough to land in the dark, and so the tides would be in their favor. He'd settled on June the 6th, when there would be a full moon, but storms set in on the North Sea in the beginning of June. Sky was too cloudy for airplanes to see their targets. There were high winds and rough seas. Eisenhower's chief meteorologist was convinced there would be a break in the weather on June 6th. And so, over the opposition of some of his commanders, Eisenhower ordered that the invasion go ahead. The Germans had been on alert for an attack, but when they saw the terrible weather, they let down their guard, and D-Day was a great success and turned the tide of the war. It's the birthday of the poet E.E. Cummings. Edward Estlin Cummings, born Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1894, wrote nearly 3,000 poems, including the one that begins, "Since feeling is first, who pays any attention to the syntax of things will never wholly kiss you." And it's the birthday of Catherine Mansfield, born in Wellington, New Zealand, 1888, a rebellious young woman who had affairs with men and women, lived with Aborigines, published scandalous stories under various pseudonyms, once wrote to a publisher, "I have a rapacious appetite for everything and principles as light as my purse." Best known now as the author of the short story, The Garden Party. Here's a poem for today by E.E. Cummings on his birthday. O sweet, spontaneous earth, how often have the doting fingers of prurient philosophers pinched and poked thee? Has the naughty thumb of science prodded thy beauty? How often have religions taken thee upon their scraggy knees, squeezing and buffeting thee, that thou mightest conceive gods? But true to the incomparable couch of death thy rhythmic lover, thou answerest them only with spring. E. Cummings' poem, O Sweet Spontaneous Earth, from his 100 selected poems published by Grove Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assistance from Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
It's just about 25 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon, sitting in for Joan Pardis. She will be back on Monday, and she'll be here next Friday as well. My next guest is a visitor to Juneau from the big city up north. And Lisa Warzonik is here. She's going to do a talk tonight about understanding adult guardianship. So, Lisa, tell us who you're with and what your position is that brings you to Juneau.
Sure. I'm the education director with the Alzheimer's Resource of Alaska. We're a statewide organization and we have a local office here with Amber Smith, who's our local representative. This is a talk that I offer because of a background in adult guardianship as a court visitor for the last 13 years, as well as my work with the Alzheimer's Resource of Alaska. So as I travel to visit our different offices around the state or other areas that we don't have offices, I can provide this type of information to the community.
What does a court visitor do?
A court visitor is sort of the eyes and ears of the court during an adult guardianship investigation. Because the judge won't go out and talk to different people, the court visitor goes out to gather information, talk to the different parties, and then try and come up with a recommendation to the court. So they're filing a report and giving the information so that the judge has a baseline of maybe what direction the parties are going to go in.
And when you say the parties, you're talking about the person who may be taking over guardianship of someone who's not capable of...
Correct. Maybe it's a family member that's petitioning, or a entity like Adult Protective Services might be petitioning. So there's always a petitioner. There's also an attorney that's appointed to represent the respondent, which is the person who may be getting the guardian or conservator appointed. And then who's going to actually be the proposed guardian or conservator. So those would be the people that the court visitor would talk to prior to a hearing to establish an order.
You mentioned Alzheimer's, but there are other conditions that might require guardianship.
Absolutely. This is certainly, and a guardianship is certainly an issue that an individual with a later stage of Alzheimer's would be affected, but other diagnoses could include mental health or mental illnesses, developmental delay, or even a traumatic brain injury. Maybe a temporary guardian is needed while that person recovers. Just having one of these diagnoses doesn't mean that that person's incapacitated or incompetent, but it's maybe a cause of that incapacity.
Now, Lisa, you're going to do a talk tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. at the same offices at Sale and United Way are in. It's over at 3225 Hospital Drive. Who are you hoping will show up?
This would be a talk for family members who may have a loved one that they're considering guardianship for. They're getting ready to petition or wondering if they should. Or even for families who have already been appointed that maybe have some questions about guardianship to maybe refresh or get some of those questions answered. It can also be for professionals who are working with family members or are working with guardians if they have certain questions about what can a guardian do, what can't they do, what should they do, what are their reporting requirements, or what if I have a concern about a guardianship, where do I turn and ask for help. So we're going to really kind of go over the ABCs of guardianship in a sense.
So if someone, for instance, knew of a situation where a guardian should be appointed, even if it wasn't a relative or something like that, they might be someone who would want to come to this meeting?
Absolutely. Those are kind of the directions that we try to point people in is what do they need to do and what are the steps to take to see about getting a guardian appointed, and then what do you do once a guardianship is appointed?
Mm-hmm. And then if someone comes to this meeting and then has other questions or something, you know, that comes up and they didn't get an answer when you were here and like that, how would they go about getting more information?
I would certainly recommend people can talk to their local attorneys, usually a probate attorney that will do adult guardianship. The Juneau area does have local area court visitors, and so they may be a source of information. And I have certainly, as I've done this talk around the state and actually cover a lot of small area courts, I've had people call me directly. So if people do have questions and they're unable to get those questions answered, or they're just wondering, who do I contact here locally? I have access to that information, and I'm happy to provide that. People can contact me at our 1-800 number at 1-800-478-1080, and I'd be happy to get them in the right direction.
And they'd ask for Lisa Warzonik when they got that 800 number. Okay. Are there web-based resources where someone can learn more about the guardianship issues? Or
there actually is. Here in Alaska, we have a video. It's about 24 minutes called Becoming a Guardian. That's on the court website. There's also, if people are looking outside the state of Alaska, maybe they have a loved one somewhere in the lower 48, there's the National Guardianship Association. So people can find resources for how do you apply for guardianship in that particular state. We've got a lot of information on the Alaskan Court website where you can get all the forms. There's a couple of manuals on how to be a guardian or how to fill out the reports, as well as the video. And then the National Guardianship Association also has a website on finding information outside of Alaska if people are needing that.
So if you did something like Googled Alaska Court Guardianship or something like that, you'd probably get fairly close to the website.
You probably would. Or if you just Googled the Alaska Court System, you're going to get to their main page. And then the national one is just guardianship.org, O-R-G.
Okay. Okay. There's no charge for the talk you're giving tonight?
This is free, open to the public, and if people are interested but maybe they hadn't planned on it, they don't have to worry about registration. They can just show up tonight at the 3225 Hospital Drive. We are in the first floor conference room.
Okay, first floor conference room at 3225 Hospital Drive. The talk starts at 6 to 8 p.m. This is a conversation this evening about understanding adult guardianship. Lisa Warzonik is coming down from Anchorage to give us this information. And Lisa, thank you so much for visiting us. I'm glad we could reward you with a little typical Juneau weather.
Yes. I've been here a few times, and I've had one sunny day out of all those trips. So.
Yeah, well, this wasn't one of them, I guess. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Bye.
This is Bird Note. As Christopher Columbus neared land in 1492, clues in the form of birds gave him hope that landfall was not far off. We read from his journal. 14 September, the crew of the Niña stated that they had seen a type of tern, which never goes farther than 25 leagues from the land. 17 September, this morning we saw a tropic bird, which does not sleep at sea. 19 September, this day a pelican came on board. These birds are not accustomed to go 20 leagues from land. By late September, Columbus's men were beginning to feel desperate about reaching landfall. Perhaps to soothe their fears, on September 30th he wrote, "Four tropic birds came to the ship, a clear sign of land. For so many birds of one sort together show that they are not straying about, having lost themselves." 7 October. Observed large flocks of birds coming from the north and making for the southwest. We accordingly shifted course. Travel to the Bahamas, and you may see descendants of the very sandwich terns that were there when Columbus's ships landed on October 12, 1492. For now, you can find a picture of a tern on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
It's just almost 3:45, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon, sitting in for Chris Pardes. My next guests are the all-Chris show today. There's a presentation coming up, Wednesday night, by Trout Unlimited, and Chris Miller is here in the studio with me, and momentarily when I push this button, then Chris Zimmer will be with us. Chris, are you there?
Chris Simmers here.
Good. Okay. Well, Chris and Chris. So the conversation that you're going to be talking about is a public event hearing about how BC mines could harm Southeast Alaska's fishing and tourism jobs. And this is a Trout Unlimited presentation. And then Chris Miller is bringing in a set of slides of the Taku River that you're going to be showing. Film as well?
No, actually, it's there are probably about 30-plus images on the wall up the Silver Bow. They went up for First Friday a couple weeks ago. So
yeah. So you're going to be talking about how you captured those images?
Unfortunately, I won't be in town. I'm leaving Wednesday.
Oh.
So Wednesday is actually more about Trout Unlimited, Rivers Without Borders, and I think SEAC. They all have some presentations that they'll be giving. And Chris Zimmer actually would probably be better to address those.
Rivers Without Borders is an organization that I had not heard the name of. It's a fascinating take on Doctors Without Borders kind of thing. So, Chris Zimmer, tell us about Rivers Without Borders in the presentation.
Oh, Rivers Without Borders, we've been working in the transboundary region for well over a decade, focusing on the Taku. And basically what we're seeing happen in the Taku, I think we may see happen orders of magnitude worse in the Stikine-Unik area. So what we've seen in the Taku is there's a proposed mine up there that's been leaking acid mine drainage for 50 years into the Taku, one of our most productive salmon rivers. And it doesn't give us a whole lot of faith that BC or the mining industry in Canada can basically do the job right and not affect Alaska's downstream interest. And what we're seeing in the Stikine and the Unik are several massive mines, big open pits, big underground mines that are 50, 60, 75 times the size of the Tulsqua Chief mine that's up in the Taku, with 60, 75 times more potential for acid mine drainage, pollution, and impacts downstream. So the key issue here is that BC is going to develop its resources, but it must develop those resources in a fashion that doesn't affect Alaska's downstream interests, and that's fish, clean water, jobs, customary and traditional activities. So what we're going to try to talk about on Wednesday is the scope of the threat and things people can do to help address it, lessen the threat, and protect Alaska's salmon and jobs. And I think Chris's pictures will be quite interesting. It shows you the best and the worst of the Taku. It shows you a fantastic landscape, the fishing industry, but it also shows you what that mine has done up there and the pollution coming out of it. So I hope people come to the Silver Bow at 6:30 this Wednesday. They can hear more. They could also learn about some things they can do to help here.
The mines that you mentioned on the Unik River, none of those are actually in existence yet. These are proposed mines up there, right?
That's correct. The biggest one is a mine called the Kerr Sulphurets Mitchell, kind of KSM for short, and it's proposed in the headwaters of the Unik on the Canadian side, and it's massive. Two open pits, two underground mines, two massive tailings dams that are bigger and higher and wider than the Hoover Dam, 2 billion tons of waste rock that will have to be stored, and a huge potential for acid mine drainage coming out of the mine and the tailings dams right into some tributaries and into the Unik itself. And even the mining company admits that it's probably going to have to treat the water coming out of that site for at least 200 years after the mine closes. And the question is, you know, who's going to be around in 200 years? Is there going to be enough money? I mean, this is a tremendously risky proposal, and it poses real risk to water quality fish and Alaska's interest downstream. So this KSM mine is probably the biggest threat down in the Stikine-Unik area. It's almost of the scale of the Pebble mine in size.
The acid drainage that you were talking about on the Taku River, how is that measured?
Well, one of the problems is we don't have good data on it. The Canadians and the mining company have refused requests for information as to the nature of that pollution, how much, where's it going. So right now we have a lot more questions than answers. It'd be relatively easy to measure, but for some reason the Canadians and the mining company have kept that information confidential, and, you know, downstream here we're kind of left with a lot of questions, no answers, and I'd say very little trust that Canada can do this job right and monitor its own mining companies.
So, but there is no agency or anyone who is measuring the acidification of the Taku. In other words, are there instruments that are applied to the downstream waters?
As far as I know right now, there are not. We don't have water quality studies going on the U.S. side, and we actually had, I believe there's money sitting in the fish and game budget that Senator Egan got to do water quality study in the Taku. We just haven't gotten to it yet. And I believe there are monitoring reports that the mining company is submitting to Canada, but we haven't been able to get copies of those. So I think if we're worried about the water quality, I think we're going to have to, you know, Fish and Game or DNR is going to have to get out there and measure it ourselves because we just can't trust the Canadians.
So, Chris Miller, when you were taking pictures on the Taku, you saw some signs of depredation?
Yeah, so actually about 4 years ago, I went up with a friend of mine, Ed Shanley, and we went up to the Tulsa Quachee mine site. And so it was actually when the mine was in receivership, so Redfern was the original company that was developing the mine, and so basically they went under, and then before Chieftain, who is now trying to develop the site, had fully formed, basically we had the opportunity to go. There was no one really there, so we were able to walk around, and I was able to document the site as it existed at the time. So.
And what did you see?
Well, basically, you know, there's the original audits from the mine where, you know, they originally would go in and they would access the mine shafts, and so basically that's all been sealed off. But at this point, effectively, you just have water running out of the side of the hill, and you just have orange kind of ooze. It's like, you know, bright red-orange mud, basically, that flows down the side of the hill and goes basically into, at the time, it was some catchment ponds that they had some, you know, protection to prevent a lot of that from flowing into the Tulsaqua, but you could see actually how it effectively had gone through that barrier and was basically flowing into the Tulsaqua itself.
Now, at this point, are there people working at the Tulsaqua mine?
Yes. So Chieftain has since attempting to develop the mine. In the process of doing so, I believe it was about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, and Chris Zimmer can correct me on this if I'm wrong, they actually built a water treatment plant. And the water treatment plant was built. They've done some mitigation, so a lot of it seems cosmetic, having flown over it, so it looks better than it did.
When did you fly over?
Let's see. The last overflight that I did was with Chris Zimmer, and that was in, I believe, May of this year.
Okay.
Effectively, the problem with the water treatment plant is it's there, but it's not actually running. It ran for maybe 6 months, if that, and then the mine, basically, they didn't have enough money to run it. So it's now just basically sitting there doing nothing.
And so the outflow from the ponds is still going. You can still see the orange streaking.
Yeah, basically what they've done is they've dumped rock over the top of it, so they've covered up a lot of that orange mud. But effectively, all of that is still flowing out of the hillside. You know, ostensibly, hopefully, it's being channeled into some catchment ponds that they've redone the lining on, and so hopefully that will help mitigate some of the problems. But in heavy water rain like we're receiving right now, you know, who knows? And that's part of what Chris was talking about, is that we don't have any of that information as to, you know, what the water quality is around the mine, above, below. There have been minimal studies done over short periods of time, so, you know, and this thing's been basically polluting since 1957 when the mine closed.
Chris Zimmer, does the technology exist to operate that mine, the Tulsaqua mine, and not leak out pollution?
Boy, it's very difficult to mine these, what they call these sulfide ore bodies, because they have an incredibly high potential for acid mine drainage. So the technology kind of exists, but the real issue is the political will. The companies, they just don't have the will to do the job right is part of the issue. But I think with the Tulsa Chief, you're looking at the wrong mine in the wrong place. It's a acid-generating deposit, it's a very wet area, and it's right on the banks of a salmon stream. Even the best technology we've seen, you're still going to have accidents and problems, and even the best technology doesn't work all the time. So there are just some places, in our opinion, you know, you just shouldn't have mines that are going to generate acid, and that's one of the big problems with the KSM mine. It's an incredibly wet area. We're looking at billions of tons of acid-generating rock right upstream of one of the biggest king producers in the region. So I think you got the combination of the values of the area, the problems with the deposit, and a real lack of political will to do the job right. And I think all that adds up to, you know, wrong mine, wrong place.
Now, there's a deadline involved in this conversation as well, and that is by October 21st, the Canadian government is going to close the environmental assessment process, the public comment portion of that. So anything that's going to be said by anyone in Alaska has got to be said by the 21st of October. Is that correct?
That's correct. The public comment period is up this coming Monday. You could go to riverswithoutborders.org or americansalmonforest.org, and there's information, and there is also a way you can submit comments directly to the Canadian government. But yeah, the public comment period closes, but after that, you know, our real hope is that our government and agency representatives, Fish and Game, DNR, the State Department, are going to engage directly with the Canadians and get some much stronger guarantees that the Canadian development is not going to harm Alaska's interest here. So there is a short term for the public to weigh in, but even after that, I think there's a lot to be done to convince our elected leaders that we need their help to protect our fish and water here on the Alaska side.
So, Chris Miller, your photos will be still on the wall at Silver Bow, so people have a chance to see those. And then, Chris Zimmer, are you going to be at the meeting, the public event?
Absolutely. I have a short presentation on the KSM mine to really describe the nature of the mine, its location, and the potential impacts on us downstream here.
Okay, so this is at the Silver Bow Restaurant on Wednesday night at 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Conversation about the mines that are talked about being built in Alaska is probably some conversation as well about the photographs that are Chris's work that are up in the Silver Bow. Gentlemen, thank you so much for alerting people to this conversation. October 16th, 23rd, Wednesday night from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Silver Bow. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Pat.
Talking, the weather folks have been concocting an updated forecast, and it looks like we'll have rain early in the evening, mainly south of the Taku Inlet, and showers likely late in this evening, patchy fog late, lows around 43, southeast winds 10 miles per hour. And then Tuesday, we're looking at mostly cloudy with patchy fog in the morning and then scattered rain showers. Tuesday night, we're looking at mostly cloudy with isolated rain showers. And Wednesday, still looking pretty good. Partly cloudy, fog in the morning, highs around 50, and the word rain does not appear on Wednesday or Wednesday night. Thursday, we're talking mostly cloudy, patchy fog in the morning, highs around 50, so it holds through Thursday. Thursday night, mostly cloudy, and then Friday, we're looking at mostly cloudy with a chance of rain again. So a couple of nice days coming up, Tuesday, Wednesday, sort of clean up some of the last-minute yard work and like that as we get ready for the winter around here. You're in tune with KTOO Juno. This is broadcasted on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay. We're on K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek. We're on K201 AM in Gustavus. We're on K220 BT in Hoonah and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and thank you very much from listeners like you. Tomorrow, Martha Moore will be the host on Juneau Afternoon. She'll be talking to Nicole Hollingstad and Dr. Carolyn Brown about Saturday's Cancer Connection Health Forum. Terry Campbell will drop in to highlight the 14th annual Lights On After School event coming up. Rosemary Hagevig will be here to discuss this tomorrow night's presentation on end-of-life issues. And we'll learn about Thursday's college fair with guest Terry Calvin. So tune in for Juneau Afternoon on Tuesday, tomorrow, with Martha. enjoying the opportunity to have been your host today for Juno Afternoon, sitting in for Joan Pardis. She will be back on next Monday, so tune in for that. And I think she'll be taking the show for me next Friday. Thank you very much. I'll see you Friday. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered.